Hello and welcome to SciLux, the podcast where we talk about scientific developments and technological changes in Luxembourg, and of course, powered by Research Luxembourg straight from the studios of RTL City. Our guest today is Ibrahim Boussard, research scientist at Luxembourg Center for Systems Biomedicine at the University of Luxembourg. Ibrahim's expertise is stem cell biology, cellular experimental neuroscience, and molecular biology. Together with Professor Reike Kruger, he received an Effenauer Award for outstanding scientific achievement in the field of Parkinson's disease research. And of course, that's why he's here, but not only to talk about his research and other interesting endeavors. Ibrahim, thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, what I understand is that you are a research scientist, so we're going to focus more about the research around Parkinson's disease.
Yes, exactly. So really the biology of the disease, what is going wrong in the brain, in the cells.
So if I want to talk more about patients, I need to talk to Professor Reike Kruger,
I assume. He's a neurologist. He sees patients, he treats patients, and he would be the expert for really the questions about the care of the patient and the treatment.
But obviously you have to know a lot about the disease itself as well, although you are definitely, I'm sure that if you are, as usual, I always like to ask this question to my guests. When you're at a party, what do you tell people? What is the short version of your expertise, right? Do you say, oh, you know, I specialize in Parkinson's disease? Because then people will exactly ask you questions. Oh, by the way, my aunt had this, right?
This what do you do? This medication, do you think? No. I tend to say I'm a biologist because that's what I'm by training, and try to explain it in a way that I'm looking at the cells and at the molecules at the molecular level to understand Parkinson's disease. So it's more a neuroscientist and not a neurologist.
So then people don't try to ask you about the medicine, hopefully, or they
exactly,
do still.
Exactly, because I cannot give advice about medical treatment.
Okay, but still, I have to ask you about a few things, because, you know, you're the first expert about Parkinson's disease in our show. I'm sure there'll be more, because this is a very important pillar of Luxembourg research, I would say.
Yes,
there's a lot going on. And I'm sure I'll invite some of your colleagues at a certain moment too. But first of all, as far as I understand, Parkinson's disease is a neurodegenerative disease. What does that mean?
So neurodegenerative diseases are diseases where we lose neurons in the brain. They die off, so they degenerate prematurely. And this then, of course, leads to a disease at a certain point when we lose too many neurons. And depending on which kind of neurons we lose, the disease can look very different. So, you know, the Alzheimer's disease, of course, and Parkinson's disease, and there's ALS, and they look all very different clinically. And this is because different sorts of neurons are affected in the different diseases. But in general, a neurodegenerative disease is a disease where a certain type of neuron die too early.
And then neurons kind of provide those connections in our brain,
exactly.
Right? So we lose the connections.
We lose with the neuron, we lose also the connections, and we lose the signaling. Therefore, then we lose physical function. So if we have motor neurons, those which signal to the muscles, when they are affected and die off, we see a disease where the people lose mobility. If it's cognitive neurons, then of course we see cognitive decline in the patients. And in Parkinson's disease, it's the dopamine-producing neurons in the midbrain. So very special kind of neurons that is, in Parkinson's disease, we say they age prematurely. So in the end, they die way before their time. And this is a continuous process, which we cannot slow down at the moment, which we cannot stop. And after a certain threshold of neurons are lost, the patients develop symptoms. And that is then when we can diagnose it as Parkinson's disease.
You said dopamine-producing neurons. What is dopamine?
So dopamine is a neurotransmitter. So we have different neurotransmitters. These are small chemicals produced by the cells, predominantly to communicate with each other. Within a neuron, we have an electrical signal traveling along the neuron, along the axon. When the neuron reaches another neuron or a muscle cell, for example, it forms a synapse. That's a little contact with the other cell. And then there is a very small space between the neuron and the target cell. And this entire structure is called synapse. And to transmit the electrical signal from the one cell to the other, we have to somehow send over a signal. And this is done with neurotransmitters. In the case of dopaminergic neurons, they produce dopamine and they transport it to the synapses. And when they need to, when the signal comes, they release it into the synapse, into the room. And then it's taken up by the other cell. There are special receptors and dopamine can bind. And usually this opens an ion channel and ions can flow in into the other cell. And like this, we transmitted the electrical signal chemically to the other cell and it can go on from there. So dopamine is a neurotransmitter.
Yeah, and I know that you actually prepared a pop quiz question for us related to that, to the discussion we've just had. Could you please ask the question? And as usual, listeners, remember the answer to this question will be only at the end of the podcast. So please listen until the end.
The question is a two-parter, and it has to do with what we've just talked about, the connections of the neurons in the brain and the transmission. So the first part of the question is, since in Parkinson's disease we are losing dopamine-producing cells, neurons in the midbrain, how many dopamine-producing midbrain neurons do you think are in the human brain? Or how many of all the neurons in the brain are midbrain dopamine-producing neurons? And the second part of this is, to how many cells do you think is a single dopamine-producing midbrain neuron connected?
Okay, so I'll be eagerly waiting for the answer because obviously I have no clue. I have to admit already at this moment that I was not a big fan of biology at school. So it's
shame.
Also, yeah, I know, it's a little bit stressful for me to talk to specialists, especially from LCSB, because I'm kind of like, oh, I'm going back to school. I need to understand it. But it's so much more interesting than my biology classes. Sorry, teachers. Definitely, because now I just want to understand. And we're talking about something that is really applicable and how we work on
really
that.
Beautiful.
Really beautiful. Why do you think it's beautiful? Oh, what do you find beautiful?
Beautiful is to get to understand, or once you have understood something, nature usually is very beautiful. I don't know. It's probably because we are part of nature, we perceive it as beautiful, but most structures and most mechanisms in biology are usually really beautiful. So, I mean, it's a feeling, it's a perception, it's not really explainable, but when you just look at the structure of DNA, this double helix intertwined and spiraling, and it's constructed in such an easy way. So for DNA, we have only four building blocks and they pair two by two. And this creates this amazing molecule, which has such a big impact, which regulates everything. The beautiful part is actually that when you can really understand it and break it down, it becomes very simple.
Yes, so there is a lot of simplicity behind it, right? But when it combines...
It creates complexity, exactly.
Yes, I understand. And also, I guess, the symmetrical part of it, right?
Also, yeah.
It's what we find beautiful, as there have been studies, right? That the more symmetrical faces and also
appear more
that...
beautiful to
exactly.
us, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I haven't really seen DNA anywhere except for, you know, like pictures in magazines. So it must be also very exciting to just go down to the molecular level yourself and just see it. And before we discuss this, because that also interests me always, like how your daily life looks like.
Yep.
I just wanted to understand. So you said that dopamine is one of the neurotransmitters. How many are there? Are we talking about, I don't know, how many do you know exactly?
So we have serotonin, we have acetylcholine, dopamine, GABA. Now you're putting me in a position. Do I forget one? I probably do right now.
Yes, sorry. Yes, that's classic me.
So
I just ask a question
a
where you're like out of your comfort zone.
Yeah.
Okay. And the dopamine, if there is a deficiency in dopamine as such, I mean, the dopamine producing neurons, are there also other diseases involved, or is very special for Parkinson's only?
There are other diseases. So there is this term Parkinsonism, which covers a little bit more than only Parkinson's disease, where we also have loss of dopamine-producing neurons. And they can, in the clinic, they can manifest very similarly early on. And then it's only later, sometimes even only at the autopsy, where doctors can see that it's actually not Parkinson, dementia with Lewy bodies or MSA. So there are other diseases also that where this is affected.
So we know that this is just down to those neurons. Why can't we just go and fix them?
So how would we do that? So once a cell is lost, the only way to fix it would be to replace it. So there is research going on, but the brain obviously is a very difficult organ to target. And how would we, even if we had the technology to grow a neuron and put it in, how would we make sure that it builds the same connections as it had before, as the one that is lost had before? So that's a very, very difficult approach for treatment. But there is indeed research going on for replacement therapy, for transplantational therapy.
But that's not what your research was about.
No. So,
or is about, I shouldn't say was.
Yeah. Let's say our dream is that we will be able to slow down the progression of the disease, or maybe even stop the progression, which would then, in combination with an early diagnosis, or would not be a cure, but we would not have a progression, the patients would not get worse. So they could live their life from that point on constantly and normally as they are at this point. So this would be like really our dream. And the other side is to detect the disease very early, because this is also a problem in Parkinson's disease. So that's what's usually called biomarker research. So we're looking for biomarkers, something that will tell us, oh, this person will develop Parkinson's disease, because then we could also, in theory, start treating before any symptoms occur, and then this person would live their life without ever having symptoms.
Okay, I know from what I read about symptoms is that one of the classic symptoms is the tremor, right? But doesn't have to be there. And also, there are other symptoms that often occur earlier, actually. So what you're saying is, like, without any symptoms, you would already know, okay, this patient has this kind of risk, let's say, of developing
exactly.
further.
So this would be the ideal state, that we recognize the disease or the potential to develop this disease with certainty. Because we don't want to treat someone who never would have gotten the disease. But if we could with certainty say this person, based on this and this biomarker we found in the blood, or that this person will definitely develop Parkinson's, then we could treat before any symptoms.
So it's about analyzing a huge amount of data of patients who already developed Parkinson's, or how do you actually look for such biomarkers?
So this is something where you need a huge amount of data. You need a huge amount of people participating in the research. Like here in Luxembourg, for example, our group, mainly Professor Krüger, has established a cohort, the LuxPark study cohort, within the NICER frame. And we recruited Parkinson's patients from Luxembourg and the greater region, but also healthy people, controls. And then you start comparing these groups on all different levels, genetically, the blood, cellularly, but also clinically. And you compare and you try to find patterns that come up in the patient group and don't come up in the healthy group. But to find a good biomarker, one thing is also that you have to do these studies over time, and that you include people that maybe have a risk to develop Parkinson, and then you can see, oh, this group developed Parkinson, this didn't develop Parkinson. Is there anything that is really distinguishing these two groups? And such a thing could become a biomarker if it holds true.
I have no clue how to look for the biomarkers, so maybe a stupid question, but just made me think. Is it possible that this biomarker would disappear once the patient develops Parkinson's disease?
Would it be a biomarker then if it disappears? So there is no preconceived concept of a biomarker. So whatever we find mm-hmm. is what we find. So let me give you a very simple example. We could look at early conditions, something that would not really ring the bell for someone who is not involved in this. Like there is a disorder that is called RBD, REM sleep behavioral disorder, where people move in their REM sleep and they shout and speak because the inhibition that usually takes place when we dream and makes us not run when we are dreaming that we are running is not functioning correctly. And turns out that if you have RBD, you have a very high risk to develop Parkinson's 10 years later. So this would be like a clinical biomarker. We can say in like, I think it's 90% of people with RBD develop Parkinson's within 10 years. And it could be also something in the blood, a protein that is maybe secreted more in people that have Parkinson's or that will develop Parkinson's. And we can maybe find it in the serum when we analyze the blood. And it could be such a thing. So we don't have anything concrete we're only looking for. You have to look for everything. It could be hidden everywhere, such a biomarker.
That's really like a Sisyphus work, I would say. It just reminds me when I was talking to Professor Emma Szymański from LCSB as well. I mean, it's a different study, obviously, but it's a little bit like, okay, so what is this chemical, right? We have no clue. We have the data and we're just kind of, you know, detective work, right? But then again, must be challenging, but rewarding if you find something.
Yeah.
Right. And something. Yes, if you would find something. But there is a story here of success in some way. I mean, I remember when we had an exchange, you downplayed it a bit because you said, but this is a very special case, this familial Parkinson's disease. And that's not, you know, the typical situation. But still, what happened with your research?
So what happened, it's a patient from Professor Krüger, Parkinson's patient, and he donated a little skin sample. And from the skin sample, we can isolate skin cells and then we can convert them back to stem cells. And from these stem cells, we can grow in the lab neurons.
So you can grow neurons.
We can grow neurons.
The problem is rather putting them inside the brain.
Yes. And making sure that these are the right neurons.
Yes,
exactly. a little bit more challenging. It's a difference whether you grow something for the lab to study it or if you grow something to put it into a human.
Of course.
So we started analyzing the cells of this patient and he had a mutation in a gene. It's called PARC7. And when this gene is mutated and not functional anymore, then you get Parkinson's disease. So if both copies of the genes are mutated, it's 100% certainty that you will develop Parkinson's disease very early even. And this mutation was described and it was thought that it's changing the amino acid sequence of the protein. This entire project started with the premise to analyze this mutated protein. But then we looked and we didn't find any protein. And this was a little strange. So we looked a little deeper and then we saw actually what is happening in the cells of these patients is not that he produces a mutated protein, but that the processing of the mRNA, which is the step before the protein is built by the cell. So usually you have the information to build a protein on the DNA. This is transcribed into RNA, which has to be processed to become a mature mRNA. And from this, then the protein can be built. And then we found the processing of the mRNA is wrong in these cells. There is actually a piece cut out that is not meant to be cut out, and then you get a very shorter mRNA, and this is not a good template to build a protein, so the cell cannot build this protein. And so this was a very exciting and lucky case because we actually found the mechanism by which the mutation is causing the disease. This is not always given. Sometimes you have a mutation and it changes the protein a little bit, but the difference are maybe subtle or you're not looking in the right place. And then you know the patient has the disease because of the mutation, but the exact mechanism.
That must be very frustrating. You know it, you
well,
see it.
Science,
and you can't find it.
Experimental science is 99% frustration, right? It's common knowledge. It's only 1% success or satisfaction. So we found this mechanism. We could explain what is going on in the cell. And once you can explain what exactly is going wrong, you also have a target where you can put on your screwdriver and try to repair it. And then we looked at these kind of mutations because they were a little bit neglected or not looked carefully enough at in neurodegenerative research or in Parkinson's research. So what we did, we took the largest database of genomic data from the largest in the world. There are consortiums that collect these and give you the possibility to analyze them. And we analyzed roughly 3,000 genomes from Parkinson patients and compared them to, I think the exact number is 2,703 PD genomes and 5,700 genomes from healthy people. And then what we've seen is there is a pattern that mutations that can cause this defect are much more represented, 20% more represented in PD patients. What is a strong indication that this mechanism might play an important role for a subset of, for subgroup of Parkinson's patients. Now, so we've seen it might be very important for a group of patients, and we have the mechanism and we have the cells of the patient. So let's try to rescue this. And then we did drug screening. So we tested different drugs, chemical compounds, substances. And
this means you test it on
the cells.
On the cells that you grow first.
That we grow. So we grow the cells and we know the cells have a shorter mRNA in our case than it is actually supposed to be. Then we grow, of course, in parallel healthy cells to always compare. And then we treat the cells and then we analyze the mRNA and we look, is it back to normal? Does it have the right length? Is the piece that is cut out pathologically remaining in the mRNA when we treat with a certain compound? And so then after a lot of testing and trying different combinations, then we came up with these two compounds in combination that then correct this defect mechanism in the cell, and the cell starts producing more of the mRNA in the correct length. And then as a consequence of having, again, we call it full length mRNA because it has the full length, then the cell is also able to produce the protein again. And then when we take these cells and we can grow them in a way which, in a structure that is called organoids, these are small 3D cell culture structures that resemble a certain part of the brain. That's why we call them organoids. They're like little representatives of the organ.
Yeah, and that's also just for our listeners. So I talked to Dr. Anna Gołębieska from LIH about glioblastoma and organoids as well. So if you're interested a bit more, we discussed it in greater detail. Sorry.
So when we grow them with the patient cells, what we see is that after growing them and then we analyze them, they have much less dopamine-producing neurons than the organoids we grow from a healthy person. And then when we treat them with our combination during their growth, then we can revert this. And then they have, again, the same number as the healthy organoids. So we even see the loss of dopaminergic neurons and the rescue of dopaminergic neurons with these two compounds. And that was the story behind this.
Okay, fascinating. For our listeners, again, another mention. Ibrahim is smiling right now. So I can see that was the aha moment when it happened, right?
Yes.
And then...
It was a Saturday.
Saturday, you remember.
I remember exactly.
You were working on a Saturday.
Yeah, this happens often in science.
Yeah, experimental, right? Again, I mean, I know how it is with science. It's just really not a 9-to-5 job, is it?
No.
Definitely not. Okay, very interesting points. And I don't know which direction to go because I wanted to discuss a little bit Parkinson's disease, but I would also want to understand your daily job, let's say, how it looks. Because, of course, when we think about scientists, we have this tendency to think, okay, lab coat, right, and a microscope. Do you actually work with microscopes still, or it's something else completely nowadays?
No, there is still a microscope. So it depends. Of course, I'm a cellular biologist, so working with cells, living cells, so then there is a lot of microscopy. So the classical microscope, you know, which is always depicted, the small one, the light microscope, we use them daily to check on our cells. Are they happy? Are they looking fine? Do I have to do something?
Happy. What does happy mean in your jargon?
Happy is they are not dying off. Okay. They are looking like neurons and not like something else.
Okay.
And they are attached to the bottom of my flask and not swimming around, which is also not good. And we use this every day. However, this is usually you take a It takes 1-2 minutes. So this typical picture, standing in front of a light microscope for several hours, this is not the case anymore. And then there is a lot of microscopy in our work where you would probably not even recognize the machine as a microscope. So we do a lot of fluorescence microscopy, confocal microscopy, and automated microscopy, where we take thousands of pictures in one session. And these things sometimes don't look like a microscope at all. So there's a big box where you put in a plate and then you sit in front of the computer and tell it what to do. And this is much more of our work, but these are then like final experiments. These are real experiments. The light microscope, you know, from every lab that is shown in a TV show, this is usually just to check on the cells.
Okay, so if you listeners are interested, you can also see the video that FNR made about you and your work. And what is in the video then? Is there these boxes and computers, or what type of lab was
so
there?
So we have a cell culture lab. We had a patient there who visited us and we showed him the lab. So there's the cell culture lab where we stand in front of a small light microscope, and he wanted to see neurons that we grow, because he was also one of the patients in our cohort who donated skin cells. So you see a cell culture lab. It's a small room which has a light microscope. It has big incubators. These are boxes in the background where we grow our cells in 37 degrees body temperature. And you see some working space on the left side. These are hoods. This is like a box where you put everything in with a glass shield, and then you can work in a sterile environment. And then you will see the what we call the open lab. This is the area where we do the molecular biology. So this is then when we don't have living cells anymore, but we have extracted something from them, and then we analyze proteins or RNA or whatever component you want to look at. And then you see our automated platform we built in ICSB, where we do drug screenings. And this again is a big box. No, it's a several boxes. So our platform is a robotic platform for doing cell culture and drug screening. This was one of our first projects. So we came to the LCSB in 2014. I came with Professor Krüger. And one of the first projects was to build a robotic platform for cell culture and drug screening. And then we have took some time for me to get into this and learn about all these different possibilities and products we have. But what I've done is I've designed a platform, like looking what is on the market, what does exist in terms of automated devices. So we need automated incubators and fridges, simple devices like this, but they have to be automated. They have to be able to be commanded by a program and to release what we want.
So like fridges nowadays with Wi-Fi that tell you, oh, the cells or whatever product you have in the fridge is not okay. Can you connect by Wi-Fi now?
It's more like we put stuff in the incubator and in the fridge, and then we tell the database, okay, in this position we have medium, in this position we have the neurons I want to analyze on Monday, and then we can program the process we want to run on Monday, and then the computer can call the fridge and say, hey, please put out the medium that is in this position. And
so you're superfluous now. It's gonna do you can go on holidays.
Yeah, so it's a nice thing. It can run overnight and stuff like this. That is the nice little nice thing about this. But the actual advantage of such a robotic platform is the throughput. So we can miniaturize experiments and we can increase the throughput of doing it. Because if you want to test 2,000 compounds in a day, there is no human that can pipette this in this time with this accuracy as a machine. So we have a lot of different devices, pipetting robots, which do what I do by hand usually, and automated centrifuge and an automated microscope to analyze our experiments in the end. And of course, a robotic arm to transfer the cells and the media reservoirs from one station to the other. So we set this up, and then we developed a lot of protocols to run on them, to grow the cells in a good quality, and also to test different drugs. And this is also seen then, I think, we have in the movie also a short clip of this one. Mm-hmm. This platform then we use after we have discovered something in the lab, in the manual lab, where we work with our hands, we are looking for differences between patient cells and cells from healthy controls. And if we find a really striking difference that distinguishes the Parkinson's cells from the healthy cell, then we can go to the automation and say, and we have established the assay by hand and we know it's working, then we can go to the automation and then start growing cells and start testing all the compounds we have in our freezers.
So it's a kind of a pre-analysis, let's say, and then you jump in and start building upon the knowledge that you got from the platform.
No, the other way around. So from the manual work, we get the knowledge, and then we exploit this on the platform and trying to find drugs and compounds that are active on what we discovered.
Is this platform accessible remotely as well, or it requires your physical presence?
It is also accessible remotely for us to a certain degree, but it can be also pre-programmed to run over the weekend or over the night, and then it does it. So usually we don't need to access it remotely unless there is a small issue, because you don't run these experiments on the fly. So they are well prepared and you have tested the protocol and you have saved it. And so you can pre-program which protocol has to run when. You don't do it in the evening from the car. That would not work.
Okay. And then you just go home and you can relax. You don't get stressed about it.
Yes. Yes. Hopefully. You know how it is with big complex devices that combine programs running and also motion of many, many, many parts, not only the robot arm, but each single device has something that is moving. There can be some little issues which requires you to come in
and
free the robot arm.
Because it got stuck somewhere.
It got stuck somewhere.
Okay, I understand. Can happen. All right. Unfortunately, I'm just quickly looking at the time and we're slowly heading towards the end of the podcast, although I would love to talk more. But yeah, there's still time. There's still a few questions I will ask. But first of all, I want to go back to the question you asked before and to reveal the answer, because I want to discuss a little bit the answers as well.
So there was two part. The one was, how many midbrain dopaminergic neurons do we have in the human brain? And this is, for me, it was when I first heard it, but I think also for other people will be surprising. It is 400 to 600,000 in a human brain. And to put this into perspective, these are, from all the neurons in our brain, only 0.0005% of all the neurons are midbrain producing neurons. However, when we lose a part of them, we develop such a severe disease that has a lot of impact on the life, on the quality of life, like Parkinson's disease. And the second part of the question was, and then you will understand why losing these neurons has such a big impact, to how many other neurons do you think one dopaminergic neuron can be connected? So these are not human data. This is from a rat brain. It is shown that a single dopaminergic neuron can be connected to up to 75,000 neurons on the other side, in the striatum usually, when cells in the substantia nigra in the midbrain, for example, they project out to the striatum where they deliver their signals to. And there, it's in the rat brain, it can be connected to 75,000.
So now I understand even better why you said, like, okay, yes, getting the neurons in the lab, that's okay, but putting them there and getting the connections right is just impossible. Yes. And also a crazy idea that, you know, such a small amount out of all the neurons has such a big influence, right? Yes. It's kind of like negligible, right?
And the impact is really big, because you asked me if there are myths about Parkinson's disease. So one of the myths or misconceptions is that it's a motor disease, a movement disorder only. And that's not it. So the motor symptoms we see are the point where we can diagnose clinically Parkinson's disease. However, the patients usually have other symptoms way before this sets in. And because dopamine producing neurons not only affect movement, but also mood and cognition. So there is We have not always, but often dementia as a symptom of Parkinson's disease. Way before you develop motor symptoms, you have, as we said, REM sleep behavioral disorder in some cases. You have depression is a very common symptom of Parkinson's disease. Loss of smell is a very common symptom of Parkinson's. Constipation is a very common symptom. Premotor symptoms, we call them premotor symptoms. So yes, and that's these few cells are having a big impact because they are important in many, many aspects of the function of our brain.
And also what I understood for the motor symptoms, so for the tremor, is that the tremor that happens in Parkinson's disease is also a very special type of tremor. It's not because of the situation, let's say, right? It's not the tremor, I don't know, stress can cause it.
No, we have resting tremor, which is there always.
Yes.
So Parkinson's patients with resting tremor, they have this tremor constantly. Mm-hmm. That is not some reaction.
Exactly,
only to
and
something.
That can be a different situation as well. When we talk about those premotor symptoms, as you said, is this a moment where we can try to stop the disease significantly? Because what we already know is that so far we just work with the symptoms, right? We try to kind of get the quality of life of the patient to a certain extent better than what could be without that.
Yes, of course. The hope is, of course, if we don't have motor symptoms yet, then we still have enough dopaminergic neurons left to have these functions work normally. And if we really one day could stop the progression, and from then on it would be aging normally, the brain, then of course we would avoid these in the patient.
Okay, and then also one of the things I noticed for not necessarily cures as medicine that the patients take is also very important is the exercise, right? That's one of the things that are always suggested as a way of relieving. But also, interesting fact for me was that one of the problems I never thought, because exactly like a layperson perspective is, I think Parkinson's, I think motor disorder, of course, and I just never put it in context. And one of the problems I've listened to a podcast with patients who are discussing their symptoms, and one of them said that they can't swim anymore, right? Because that's the coordination between the arms and the legs just doesn't work, right? There is a bigger risk of drowning in general as well, right?
Drowning, falling is falling very, too. Very big risk for Parkinson's patients.
So what we can say only is that we hope that in a couple of years I'll meet you again in the Silax podcast with some, again, better even news, right? With aha moment, maybe not on a Saturday. I know you have a family, maybe better during the week. You discover something else. Or I'll talk to Professor Kruger or whoever else will be in the team to discuss other good news on the Parkinson's disease research or other research. Yes. And thank you so much for coming today. It was a real pleasure and really interesting.
Thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure.
This is it for today. That was Ibrahim Boussad talking about Parkinson's disease and his research. I hope you enjoyed it as usual. Please don't forget to subscribe, to follow us, to rate us also in all the podcasting platforms. And remember, we are also on RTL Play and on the website too. This was Silax, and my name is Hanna Siemaszko.